I'm here with Jeff Wall to talk about his current exhibition at the Tate Gallery, London. Jeff, I'd like to begin by discussing The Destroyed Room. This is a work that's been written about extensively in terms of art history. And I'd just like to ask you how you view this work now and seeing it, of course, included in this exhibition.
I see that picture now as a way of putting quite a few things behind me. Things like being involved with art history, being involved with painting in at least one way, and just my past struggling with how to practice photography or how to practice something. Because when I made that picture in 78, I hadn't really been active as an artist for a while. That was a consequence of that kind of rethinking that a lot of young people did in the 60s, where in some ways everything was called into question, and what we had been doing as younger people, we paused in, or in some cases, of course, turned away from completely. I had a long pause that lasted 5-6 years, and during that time I did become a student of art history. I did try and change my relation to painting, which was something I'd done since I'd been a child, and had sort of grown up in that period trying to imagine what sort of artist I might really be. At some point, I kind of accepted that I was drawn to photography and had been for a long time. I accepted the fact that I didn't want to be a photographer the way it had been defined at the time, that I had to change my relation to my own affection for painting. I had to work through some sorts of ideas that I had or thought I had about art and about the art of the past and about the tradition of modern art and the tradition of the avant-garde and so on. I turned toward studying, maybe in the absence of another solution to my problems, for a while. And I wanted to change my relation to all those things. And I knew that the only way I could change my relation to all those things was to make something. So by the time I got back into the studio in the middle of the 70s, I was in a hurry. I knew I had to do something, and I had to do it now. And maybe that was good, because at that point of impatience, a lot of things came forward for me: photography, color photography, something to do with scale, something to do with cinema, something to do with painting, all these things that I was interested in, and I had to find a way to put it together. And without really knowing what I was doing, that image just kept coming forward. It had to do with something I'd been talking about with my students in teaching. It had to do with having seen the Delacroix painting in the past. It had to do with spending 3 years in Europe and 5 years really reflecting on things. It had to do with a lot of stuff like that. And finally, it just kind of clicked and came together that way. So that picture was a kind of a door through which I kind of walked, I feel, to kind of start doing what I think I've been doing ever since. It just occurred to me at some point that I could make photographs by preparing something in order to be photographed. That wasn't a new thought. Obviously, that's been done since the beginning of photography. Anybody who ever put a flower in a vase and then took a picture of it was essentially doing the same thing that I was doing. There was no innovation involved in preparing something, even something relatively elaborate, to be photographed. It was a way of doing photography that went back, as I said, to the beginning of photography. And I suppose that's why, in a way, I could simply plunge ahead and do it. It wasn't conventional. But at the same time, color photography and a larger scale of photography were in the air with people like Gilbert and George and other people at that time who were beginning to see potential in the scale on which photographs could be experienced. So it was a moment for photography that was coming. And so the notion of preparing something artificial, the notion of making the photograph bigger and working in color all sort of came together at the time. When I decided I wanted to work in color, what was then called Cibachrome was the most permanent and stable color medium, and probably still is, although it's no longer called Cibachrome. It came in an opaque version on paper and a transparent version. And I tested the opaque version first, but I didn't like the surface texture of the Ciba paper at the time. It was too reflective. So I thought, well, I'll try the transparent. And it looked very interesting, and suddenly there seemed to be possibilities to work with that medium that I hadn't anticipated.
When you first made that work, it seemed almost larger. Well, it did seem larger than it does today, which is a kind of odd thing to say, but because it was the first time really people had seen photographs on the scale of paintings in that way, did it seem very monumental to you? I mean, how did you, you know, you suddenly saw it in a light box? People weren't working in light boxes. These were an extraordinary way to work at the time.
I never wanted to make big photographs. It wasn't that. It was a sense that I'd gotten, mostly from looking at paintings, that images on a certain physical scale are experienced differently. I felt that when pictures were larger, we could feel even a little more intimately related to them. And so I thought that I would try and work with photography on a scale similar to the successful scales I'd seen in painting, and then through that to real scale, that is one-to-one scale, or the scale of the world in which the picture's being looked at, to try and bring those closer together. It was dynamic to do that, and I feel there's a sort of new intimacy that one can get through that.
Can we discuss, keeping to the theme at the moment of the kind of art historical, to another work, Restoration, because that is done with a panoramic camera. It's a different mode of working, but also because it's fascinated critics writing about it, because there's so much in it that's about art history, about how you look at details in paintings.
That picture was made almost 15 years after The Destroyed Room, so by that time I'd kind of done some other things and begun to work with a computer. I'd gone to see the Bourbaki Panorama at the invitation of Martin Schwander, who was head of the museum in Lucerne. And when I went to Lucerne the first time to look at the galleries and talk to him about the show, he just said, I want to show you something. And he took me to the panorama just to show it to me, thought I might find it interesting. It almost immediately struck me that I could make a picture there, either about the panorama as it was, which probably would have been a nice picture too, or to imagine what it would be like if the panorama would get under restoration. And the panorama needed restoration in 1993. It was in declining condition. It's since been restored. So I started thinking about the possibility of making a picture and sort of intervening in the situation, staging the early moments, the early part of the restoration process. You know, I engaged professional conservatory restorers. All the women, people doing the main work, are actually restorers, not just...
Was that important to you, that they actually were restorers?
Well, I needed their expertise to know what they would be doing at that stage. I wanted this picture to be very accurate, even though the restoration wasn't really happening yet. If it were beginning, what would happen? I photographed the restorers in my normal cinematic way, that is, we collaborated. But the panorama had a lot of visitors every day, and while I was working, there was also visitors coming in and out. We weren't alone there. And so quite often there were people in the panorama watching us at work. They weren't totally aware of what we were doing, but they were there. And I photographed a lot of visitors, too, who didn't know I was photographing them, because the panorama camera doesn't look like a camera. Anyway, it's very easy to photograph people without them knowing what you're doing. And I realized at a certain point in the production that I would be able to blend the images of the people I was collaborating with some images of visitors who had no relation to me and didn't know they were being photographed. That was something that had been made possible by the digital montage, that I could blend so-called actual photographs, straight photographs, and photographs with collaboration into one seamless image. In the end, I cut out most of the viewers and only left, I think, two or three of them standing in the shadows. But that blend was something really exciting for me, because it showed me that there was no real boundary line between reportage and what I was doing, that the boundary was rather fluid, and that there was no set rules for how one could deal with that interaction.
In the Tate, Dead Troops Talking, I just wanted to talk about that because it's in a room on its own and has a quite mesmerising effect viewed in that way. Your work always has a sculptural quality, that particularly the relationship of where we stand with the creator And also, I think, in terms of political affairs and all the things that have been going on. And I'd like to talk about that in terms of the way that your work often looks at political situations. You have done works where you've dealt with Native Canadians. You've done work that have dealt with homeless people.
I mean, like anybody else, I live in a society, I'm a political animal, so I have a political life like any other citizen. But I don't like to have one as an artist. Subjects don't strike me because of their meaning on that level. They strike me because of the way they look or because of the interrelations that might be disclosed or the dynamics or who knows what exactly. It's really hard to say why something strikes you. But for a while, I was interested in conflict. And so I did a series of pictures that contained little moments of conflict. That's what was interesting to me at that time when I did pictures like Mimic or Milk or a few others like that. And it still interests me because I think conflict is fundamental and I'm probably drawn to it in some way. And therefore, I notice it. Other people probably go right past them. They're not tuned into that sort of thing. And I'm probably not tuned into other things that I'm missing all the time, and I'm not making pictures along those lines, though I'm trying to not let that happen to me. I know that a lot of my pictures appear to be engaged with public affairs, and I guess they are, but I'm not. I think that depiction pictures aren't really very good at telling you much about what's happening in the world, except how it looks when it's happening. And how it looks when it's happening is important somehow, because when we see the world and happenings in the world and events in the world depicted, we change our own relationship to how we see them. And I suppose that's the key thing as to how any depiction might affect any viewer. I can't say that when I made a picture like Mimic, which depicts a racist gesture, that I really had any particular strong feelings about racism. I don't think you can see them in the picture, except that it's not a very pretty sight. But at the same time, the mimic in that picture is creating something. He's in fact creating a depiction. So there's a sense in which he's accomplishing something. It's not something that we might admire, but the accomplishing of it makes it complicated. And that's what struck me, is that despite the fact that he was leading himself and everyone around him toward a less good world, if you want to put it that way, he was still accomplishing something, he was creating something, and that ambiguity of why people do things and what the consequences are and where it comes from, that's intriguing and always has been, and that's what people like to make pictures of. But I don't think that tells you why it's right or wrong. I don't think it tells you why it even happened. It just shows you and reiterates how it feels to see it. And when you see it in a picture, when it's not really happening, then your relationship to the event is transformed, and in that transformation, I think something artistic emerges, and then we take it where we're going to take it.
I just wanted to talk about some other works and then move to the black and white works. Mies van der Rohe work.
It's called Morning Cleaning.
Sorry, Morning Cleaning.
Yep, there's another term I've used a lot for my pictures, at least in the last 15 years, and that's near documentary. And what I mean by that is a process in which I see something that really happens, I don't photograph it, and in the process of not photographing it, I feel like I develop a relationship to it. It's paradoxical maybe not to photograph things, but that's how I do it. In a way, I feel it's a sort of an expression of my own freedom as an artist to relate to events my own way, not in photography's way, not in the press's way, not in the audience's way, but just my way is how I do it. That's just who I am. So when I do come back to something, I think I can make the claim that there's a certain faithfulness to the original experience, and the picture you're seeing is a report on what happened to me. And therefore, it has a relationship to documentary photography. It has a report to the kind of truth that documentary photographs contain. And Morning Cleaning was an example of that. In fact, it began as an invitation to do a photograph of a prominent architectural work, and it's not something I would be necessarily enthusiastic about doing, since I'm not an architectural photographer and I don't do commissions. But, you know, things just set you off. The house in question was another glass-walled building by another architect, and I went to visit it, and the cleaning person was there. And, of course, it immediately struck me how resonant the cleaning of windows was in a building like that. And that gave me one of those subjects that I more or less immediately knew I could take somewhere. But I couldn't use that house for one reason or another. And through another circumstances, I got to use an even better one, which was the Barcelona Pavilion, which is basically unbeatable. That's the glass building par excellence. And every morning at the Barcelona Pavilion, the cleaners prepare it for the day, because it's a public building now and it takes a lot of wear and tear. The cleaner you see in the picture is the cleaner. And he's doing what he always does. He's just doing it slightly differently in order to accommodate me as a photographer. But in fact, that picture is extremely close to what you would see if you were at the pavilion at 7:15 in the morning. It is a reconstruction, but nothing has been added to it that wouldn't be there. And I think the claim that it makes to being near documentary is, you know, rather defensible. But what I feel I've added to it is just my ability to compose, to choose the time of day and year, to deal with the colors and so on, and just to build the picture in my own way. The camera position that the picture is made from is one of the maybe 10 cardinal camera positions that photographers use to photograph the Barcelona Pavilion, because it photographs best from about 10 places. But it is slightly off the one that's normally used, but not by much. I just made a slight inflection, which I thought made it a little bit better. So there's almost nothing original in that picture, in the sense that where it's taken from is very conventional. What's going on in it is real. That's what the place really looks like. No lighting was added, nothing. You know, it's absolutely straight. And so I feel that picture's a really good example of this strain of near documentary.